Okay.
Should we answer my question about this on this thing?
Okay, thank you so much for coming.
I want to thank everyone for coming. Some people are coming from down the block or the other side of town. Some people are coming from over the bridge. So however much yigia you put into to this opportunity for more Limanot Torah together, Ashreichen. And I want to particularly thank Zahava for stepping into her old role that I think some of the people here remember from high school days of bringing the chevra together to learn. So thank you for once again doing that. And the idea was to have opportunity over the course of the summer to at least three shiurim to come together tonight and then the next 2 weeks on Monday nights at the same time, 8:15 until 9 o'clock, to look at some practical topics in kitchen kashrus. Whether you're new to running the kitchen, looking forward to running a kitchen, or you have a couple of decades under your belt or apron strings of whatever the proper term is of running the kitchen, I'm hoping that we can do a couple of things to learn halachos, to learn facts, and also to be able to back up and understand the principles that drive those dinim, which will enable us both to look at situations and understand what to do, understand how to handle things, understand how to test things up, as well as often things won't be 100% clear, but it will a knowledge of the dinim and a knowledge of a greater understanding of the principles allows also for a much more confident, intelligent asking of shilas. Sometimes people feel uncomfortable asking shilas for a variety of reasons. You should never feel uncomfortable asking a shilas. That's what we're here for. People, rabbanim, in wherever community you're from, are more than glad to field your questions. Sometimes people feel uncomfortable they're wasting the rabbi's time. Absolutely not. Sometimes people feel uncomfortable because I ought to know this myself. So that's also not at all a reason to feel hesitant about asking. You should always feel comfortable asking. But you'll feel more comfortable and you'll feel more confident if you can ask a shayla more intelligently because you have more background and you can set things up. So both for our own knowledge, for our own understanding, and to be able to move things forward with confidence. So those are some of the goals we have going in to look at some of the practical topics in kitchen kashrus. And our starting point is actually Parshas HaShavua. I kid you not. Because it's hard to think of a better parsha in which to begin a conversation about kashrus in the kitchen than, ironically, Parshas Matos. If I had to ask you which parshas of kashrus, I would think like Shmini, you think of Mishpatim, Kisisa. It's actually Parshas Matos. And it's ironically in the middle of, it's a story, it's a military story. The Jews go to war against Midian, and they have tremendous military success. This is the last couple of months of Moshe Rabbeinu's life. Aaron's already passed away. Elazar, his son, is already the Kohen Gadol. And Kadosh Baruch Hu gives Moshe Rabbeinu instructions. It's time to go to war against Midian. And they find incredible military success. And there's a large chunk of Parshas Matos which concerns itself with how you dispose of everything that you got. All the stuff that came back, the booty of war, what do you do with it? Stuck in the middle of all the numbers and the accounting is a couple of key psukim, where Elazar HaKohen Gadol, if you want to take a look in the Chumash inside, the end of Shlishi of Matos, it begins Perek Lamed Aleph Pasuk Chaf Aleph. Elazar the Kohen Gadol tells the soldiers, by the way, all those pots and pans and other kitchen implements that you brought back from war, there's a way to handle them, to process them, so we can use them in our own kitchens. And that is, and Rashi points out that Elazar has given them several sets of instructions, two of which are relevant to us. One is you're going to have to kasher, and two is you're going to have to tovel. And we'll get to both of those. We'll get the Mirtz Hashem to the Tevila as well, not tonight. But the idea of kashering kelim, the Gemara in a couple places wants to know, Gemara in Psachim, in Maseches Vorozar, primarily Maseches Chulin, the Gemara wants to know, Gemara points out that the basic concept that lies behind the details of kashering kelim, We'll get to the details of Kashrut came as well, but first let's take a step back. The whole notion that pan was used for frying bacon, so I can't just take it home and use it to make eggs. Well, what's wrong with that? No, I cleaned it. The Torah says you can't eat. Torah has a list of 20, 25, 30 different items which are machalos asuras, forbidden foods. So non-kosher animals, like bacon, and non-kosher seafood, and the kosher species didn't have a proper shechita, and the veil, and so on, and a whole list of basa b'chalav, and so on and so forth, orla fruit from the first few years, true, shvias fruit, so on and so forth, a whole list of items which are, because of what they are, categorized as machalos asuras. Foods you can't eat. Okay, so I get that. But to eat a piece of bacon, that'd be a violation of behemoth tamea. But I'm not eating a slice of bacon. There's not even a bit of grease. I scrubbed the pan clean. Now I want to make eggs and cheese. So, all I mean is that I'm eating eggs and cheese. I'm not eating bacon. I'm not eating behemoth tamea. So what's wrong? Well, why does Elazar Kohen Gadol tell the Jews that, by the way, you're going to have to kasher this, you have to figure out the details. How are you going to go about kashering the tray for frying pan? Wait a minute, what tray for frying pan? It's not meat. It's metal. Where did the Torah say you can't eat metal? So embedded in this little episode in Parashas Matos is the notion that the Torah didn't just forbid, when the Torah gave us a list of 20, 25, whatever the number is, of forbidden food items, machalos asuras, the Torah wasn't just saying you can't eat chunks of bacon, you can't eat chunks of lobster, and so on and so forth. The Torah is saying that, but the Torah is also saying the broadening principle that the psukim here in Matos bring to the fore is what the Gemara calls ta'am ke'ikar. That the ta'am, the flavor, is like the ikar, like the actual item. Just like I can't actually sit down to a slice of ham, I also can't eat potatoes, beef, broccoli, that has flavor of the ham absorbed within it. So if I make beef and broccoli with non-kosher meat, so it's not enough to say, well, I'll pull all the pieces of meat and I'll rinse off the broccoli and I'll eat it. Well, there's no residue of meat, but it's absorbed flavor. Tam ke ikar. The ikar, the actual item, that was the tray for beef. The tray for beef is gone. I'm eating broccoli. What's wrong with eating broccoli? Well, the answer is, it's broccoli with a tam of the tray for beef. Now, the truth is, as we begin to think about the concept of tam ke ikar, and the Gemara has several sources in Chumash, but where we does a little bit of detective work. We know there's this concept of Tam Ke'ikar, the Mishnayos are full of it. Where did the Tanaim find it in the Chumash? So the Gemara works at several sources and several passages in the Chumash that seem to be assuming the concept of Tam Ke'ikar. And one of the primary candidates is what we were just talking about, Parshas Matos. The fact that you have to kasher kelim implies, obviously, that something's there that you have to get rid of. It was fascinating, by the way, just to begin to think about the concepts here, is that the case I gave you is actually a little bit simpler, a little bit more obvious than the case in the Chumash. Because think about the case I gave you, right? You have beef and broccoli with tray for beef, then you're going to just rinse off the broccoli. Or let's say you made a chalent, and then you realize that some of the pieces of meat that went into the chalent actually were not kosher. Right? So I'll take out all the meat, but how about the beans and barley? The potatoes, it's not meat, not trade for meat, but it's food that's absorbed a tam, a flavor of something non-kosher. The Torah actually speaks about an even more indirect situation. Because remember, the Torah sort of jumps to stage two. The Torah didn't just say, well, if you cooked your meat with their meat, you can't eat your meat either. The Torah actually said, forget about their meat. It's their pan. So that's really right, two stages. Right? My meat and their meat is never touching. The beef and broccoli, it's one step. The flavor goes, I cook the beef and broccoli together, so now the flavor of the beef gets embedded, absorbed into the broccoli. So that's direct. The Torah speaks about, in Parashas Matos, it tells us a greater chiddush, a more expansive idea, that even the flavor makes a stop. Right? I'm cooking entirely kosher ingredients, but with non-kosher equipment. So that means that the flavor is now made two steps removed. The flavor went yesterday, this morning, they made ham and eggs for breakfast in this pan, so the flavor of the ham went into the pan, step one. And now step two, we fought against the Midanim, and we captured these pans, and we took them home and we scrubbed them down. Again, a lot of eating probably going on together. It probably makes you hungry, right? You take the pans home. So Elijah says you can take those pans home. Don't think you can just scrub them down and use them for for your own eggs and cheese, because the flavor that went in this morning into the pan is now going to come out, stage two, and that, even that is a problem. So not only is Tom cake, the Torah is really telling us, is think about just how much we derive from just reading these psukim, and just sort of thinking about, nothing fancy, just sort of thinking about what the Torah is telling us. Right, Torah is A, telling us there's a concept of Tom Kaker, which again, as I said before, we all know, but just we sort of intuitively know Tom Kaker, but let's think about it conceptually a bit. Right, it's a broadening principle that acts on the list of Machalos Asuras, that all those Machalos Asuras, not only you can't eat the Iker, but you can't have the Tom. And then the Torah tells us as well that you can even have, it's even going to be a problem with Tom Sheni. Not only if I cook the beef directly with the treif meat, but even if the treif meat was in the pan, and then later on, the flavor is going to jump from the pan into broccoli, that too is a problem. Okay. So that's sort of where, that's our point of departure. We have a little passage in Chumash, which tells us to prepare the kalim for kosher use. You need to kasher, you need to tovos, Rabbi tells us, the tefillah again we'll get to. And the kashering, Rabbi tells us that kashering is one application of a more basic principle of Tom Kicker. And with a little more work, and a little more thinking, a little more learning, that this will ultimately, this concept of Tom Kicker, we're going to figure out how it plays itself out in all sorts of practical situations. We'll have to talk about going forward about countertops and microwaves and ovens and sharp knives and sharp foods. And so all those situations are applications of this principle. Develop a couple more categories and then things will start to fall into place. I'm hoping, though, so that's sort of our point of departure. That's where we get started. That's why Parshas Matos, we didn't really plan this. But then as I started to prepare the shiur, I realized this worked out. It's a tremendous siman tov. Because this is the perfect point of departure. Over the next couple of shiurim, I'm hoping to do is that we will together have a chance to work on developing some more of this idea of Tom Kaker and talking about a couple of variables that come into play, three or four or five variables that come into play. As you get comfortable with what the sort of the dimensions, so to speak, of Tom Kaker are, so we begin to think about familiar situations in new ways, with more understanding, situations in the kitchen, the oven and the countertop and the fleishiks in the milchuk pot and the parvafu in the milchuk pot and so forth and so forth, they'll all sort of start to take shape in a new way. We'll talk about the practicalities of kashering as well. We're actually going to jump into that in a couple of minutes, Mirtz Hashem. And we'll get to, certainly not tonight, probably not next week either, probably the last year, we'll talk a little bit more about Tefillas Kalim. But before we jump into more content, just a word about the way I hope this runs. This is sort of set up very frontally. I guess Baruch Hashem is too large a group for us to all sit around the table. But I hope to not be doing all the talking on two levels, a few levels. Number one, I hope you'll be comfortable throwing a lot of questions. Number one. Sometimes the question will have to wait because it's a great case and we need to develop some more ideas. But please, please, please feel free to jump in. And not just questions, but conversation. And questions could be in the course of this year. And also, I would love for, this couldn't happen for this year, but for next week and the week after, I would love to build the direction of the shiur around what you're wondering about. So if there are cases, there are situations, there are ideas, there are questions, so whether it comes up during the shiur, or whether you want to send it to me or to Zahava or however, over the next week, so that would be great. I would love to reshape. That's why I didn't put out in advance, like, we're doing this year one, this year two, this year three. I want this to be flexible, and I want it to be most helpful for you. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about kashrin. Let's start there, even though there's sort of a big, wide world of Tom Geiker, and kashrin is sort of one particular application, but it is a good place to start. It appears in the Chumash. It's going to come up a lot. And when the answer to the shaila is you got to kasher it, so I often find when I talk to people about practical shailas, there's sort of this assumption that here's what we did, the spoon, the pot, whatever the details are. So do I have to throw out the food, do I have to throw out the pot? Right away, throw out the food, throw out the pot, throw out the fork. It's like, whoa, 1 second. The food, maybe you have to throw again. A lot of different variables at play. So if food is non-kosher, so food is not kosherable. Right? Once the broccoli absorbs the flavor of the meat, so there's no way to expunge it, there's no way to extract it, and the broccoli is again, if the meat was treif, right? Ham and eggs, so there's no way to make the eggs kosher. But the pan, typically, that's what the Torah tells us, that the default position is if there was, if the kli absorbed flavor, there will be cases where it's unfixable, but the default position is that it is fixable. So let's talk a little bit about how that works, and it'll give us a first item to walk away right away, sort of in hand. Here's a practical set of steps, and it'll also sort of open our minds to a couple of the different variables, that dimensions of the application of Tom Kicker. Okay, so let's talk about, anyone want to give us a starting case to talk about? What's your favorite case you have to tell? Yeah, go for it. Okay. Traffic clean number one.
The other week, my parents were away and I had people over for like Shabbos, so I took our like wooden salad bowl and I made like a meat salad in it. Everything was cold, and then my mom comes home and
goes,
why is the salad bowl in the flaychik sink? And I go, what do you mean it's a flaychik salad bowl? She goes, it was par.
Now it is.
Like, now it's a flaychik salad bowl.
Now I'm in trouble, so yeah.
Okay. Excellent. It might not be Fleischer. Okay. You always have to, that's always worth asking, because it might not be, things are often not as bad as you think. Sometimes if you're not able to determine what the halacha is, you may have to take the more stringent route, but if you find out, you may often discover one of the great things about asking Shilas is often things are more kal than you thought they were. So one of the main, the first dimension, before we even get to how we would kosher that, so sort of the way we think about that question.
Huh? It's not kosher, it's just not allowed.
Right, well, how we make it par. Okay. If it has absorbed flavor, how we would extract that flavor, right? If it became fleishik, so it's fleishik, which is fine, you use it for fleishik, so you want to make it par, we could kosher it, and kosher in the sense of put it through boiling water, whatever we need to do to extract that flavor, and then it goes back to the way it was before. And that's what the Torah describes in Parshas Matos. But first, let's talk about if that's even necessary. Because the first question you think about, the first sort of dimension of Tam Ke'ikar, is, okay, so we have this principle in the Chumash that it's conceivable that a previously kosher food or a previously neutral utensil absorbed flavor. So the first question you have to ask yourself is, well, how did that travel happen? Well, the method, how did that transmission happen? So there are a couple of methods of transmission. There are four or five. The main one, the famous one, the one that Torah seems to talk about here, is heat. You cook two foods together, or you cook a food in a container. So the assumption is when things are hot, as we know, right, that when things are hot, flavor gets, that's one of the main principles of the, like into the chemistry, but that's obviously what a lot of what you're trying to accomplish when you cook is you want to blend flavors. Right? That's the basics of soup making and shalom making. So flavors are shared between different foods that are heated together, and flavors are shared between food and utensils that are in contact and hot together. For the purposes of koshering, the Torah makes a slight distinction between whether it was dry heat or wet heat, but for now, let's just leave that. Those are sort of details. So the most famous method of Tom transfer, the transmission of flavor, is through heat. Okay, and heat means over as it is in Hilchos Shabbos. Heat is defined by the somewhat amorphous term Yatzel Adasbo. Now, there's a range of temperatures what that might mean. And the range of temperatures has to do with two interpretations, as Rabbi Willow points out, what the word soledes means. Yad Soledesbo appears in Shabbos Daf Mem Amud Beis in the Gemara. Yad Soledesbo has something to do with pulling your hand away when it's hot. But Yad Soledesbo could either, that could happen two very different ways. One is, you know it's hot, and you can't hold it. That's pretty hot. The other one is, you had no idea, you thought it was cold, right? And you touch it, and you're shocked, and your hand snaps back. That's a significantly lower temperature. If you know to expect the heat, you brace yourself, and you can probably hold 150, 160 degrees, depending on your tolerance, right? If you know to expect it. Right? 160 is already pushing it. 170, 180, it's going to be extremely difficult. Certainly 140, you probably could hold. If you know to expect it, you can stick your hands in the hot water and wash the dishes. Right? No problem. But if you thought it was cold, and you stuck your hands in, you might jump back instinctively. So that's why Zohar Willick points out the reason why there's such a range in terms of the opinions of what constitutes Yad Salat as well. So the OU, for instance, assumes that once you're past 120 degrees, you're already in the zone where it may already be outside as well, 120, 130, 140, somewhere around there. So once you hit 120, that already becomes a potential outside as well, and you're already concerned with the possibility of time transfer. There, as an aside, just a little bit of color, one of the reasons why that number happens to be very important, 120, is because, if I remember correctly, chocolate scorches over 122 degrees. Have you ever worked in a chocolate factory? Somewhere in the 120s, chocolate scorches. So it's very sensitive to heat. So if one were to take the position that the Yad Salat is 140 degrees, so then chocolate would not given a hashkacha to chocolate, it would be a lot simpler because it's all halachically cold. But since we assume that by the time you hit 120, you're already in the danger, you're already in the red zone, so chocolate making is considered to be a hot process in halacha, and therefore you have to kasher your equipment before you use it. And as an aside, just sort of give the industrial perspective, another thing about chocolate making, in addition to the fact that it's extremely sensitive to heat, water is a big no-no. A drop of water in chocolate making throws everything off. It's oil-based, and you want to keep it that way. So kashering is usually done with water, and kashering chocolate equipment is a somewhat complex procedure. That's probably not going to happen in your kitchen, unless the last name happens to be Ghirardelli, and you run a chocolate factory in San Francisco. When you make chocolate in the kitchen, you usually do it in double boiler, and those are pots that you can easily wash out with water. Let's bring it back. The first major, again, in talking about Tom, we're talking about your salad bowl of questionable pedigree, the first issue raises for us is that the first major question to ask about Tom Kaker, the first dimension of Tom Kaker is, well, how was the Tom transfer? What are the methods of transmission? So again, method number one, the most famous one, is heat, right? Above Yad Salat is Bo, practically speaking, over 120 degrees, we're already worried about heat. If it's just lukewarm, that's not a problem. But if it's hot, if the food is hot, the pot's hot, then you're ready. You have yourself a potential for time transfer. If there's no method of transmission, then nothing even got started. If there was heat, okay, that's number one. There are also methods of time transfer that can work without heat. I'll just list them now. Maybe we'll get to them at great length a different time. The Gemara says that if you soak something, even in cold liquid, for a period of 24 hours, so that already it's called, we call kavush, kaf beis bav shin. If it's soaked for a period of time, so even though it's cold, that's sort of how pickling works. Either you soak in a bland liquid for 24 hours or more, or if you soak in something sharp even for a couple of minutes, you sauce, if it's sitting in salt or sitting in vinegar, for even a handful, a couple of minutes, it's already problematic. That's one type of cold flavor transfer. Another type of cold flavor transfer, Gemara says, Shulchan Aruch quotes, if you have a very porous piece, spongy piece of meat, a spongy piece of food that dips into liquid. Let's say a spongy piece of meat falls in some milk drips on it. So if you have a piece of raw meat and milk falls on it, so it may look very scary, but the truth, you have a cold, raw piece of meat and the milk splattered on it, there was no time transfer, right? There was no heat. It didn't sit there for 24 hours. It sat there for a couple of moments. It's not spongy, it's raw meat, so you wash it off carefully and you move on with your day, strange as that may seem. But if it's a well-cooked piece of meat and it's more porous and milk spills over it, so you can't just wash it off because the milk got absorbed in, so that's another type of time transfer. So again, so methods of time transfer, number one is heat, number two is a 24-hour soak or even a short soak with something sharp or salty. Number three is if it's spongy. And finally, number four, and this is a big one, is the what we could call the double sharp. A sharp instrument and a sharp food. the combination of, let's say, cutting onions, cutting pickles, or spearing onions and pickles with a fork. You have a combination of a sharp tool, pressure, together with a sharp food. So that's the Mishnah is telling us that also, even though there's no heat. You're cutting a parva onion with a milchik knife. So there's no heat, there's no soaking, and there's nothing spongy, but this is an independent method of time transfer. Sharp food with pressure. If you're interested in the halachic terminology, is davar charif. Davar charif is a sharp food, and the pressure is called duchka. This I wish I had a board. I'm sorry. I should send an email afterwards. Terminology, but those are again. So those are the four or five. We'll call them four methods of time transfer: through heat, through soaking, either 24 hours or something sharp, through or into something spongy, and finally the sharp food with the pressure. Sharp food with a sharp tool. I think that's everything is S that helps it to remember. Right? The heat, and then it's soaking, salting, spongy, and sharp. Yes. Questions?
For those of us who don't have a kitchen thermometer, how would we know when we hit 120
right.
over?
And so that's a great question. Even if we had the kitchen thermometer, you're probably not going to have it handy at that moment. So if you're a scientist, or you have this sort of that bent of mind, so you might spend 20 minutes with slowly heating water with a thermometer, sort of getting the feel of what 120 feels like. If you have time on your hands, this is not a bad idea. I don't have time now for a story, but I have a friend who's very technically, mechanically minded. So he actually did for Shabbos purposes. He actually opened up urns and fitted them with thermocouples and then closed them up and then tested temperatures. But if it's not your thing, that's fine. It may be worth trying testing once to start feeling, but you know when something is hot, as opposed to something just lukewarm. So if it really feels hot, if you're not sure, if something is warm, but totally easy to touch, and you know, I mean, think about it, would you, if you touched it, would you be surprised? Or like, you wouldn't react. It's sort of the best way to get a sense over time. If you play over, if you actually spend 20 minutes or just over time, you actually using a thermometer in real life, you may just get a sense of where Yael says, but sometimes you'll say, look, I'm not really sure. That's part of the trial. Well, some of the data for the Shaila are, how hot was it? I'm not really sure. It was somewhere around there. What wasn't really hot, lukewarm, that's fine to not know. If you have the facts, you have the facts. If you own the facts, then we'll figure out what to do when we don't. The halacha also addresses situations where we're not sure of all the facts. But yeah, over time, you will develop a sense. So coming back to your salad, wooden salad bowl. So the truth is, if you use a wooden salad bowl, a power of a salad bowl, for what was it? Was it again? For fleishik?
It was power, and I made like a meat salad.
Turkey, kind of chunks. Okay. So the first question I would ask you is, first what we will all ask is, did the bowl even become, was there even any method of time transfer? If there's no method of time transfer, then we stop right there, nothing to talk about. If there was, then we have to figure out how bad it is. So they say, it wasn't soaking. It wasn't, there's nothing salt in it. It wasn't spongy, obviously. That's only with food. And you weren't cutting, onions or pastrami on the, something like that, spicy pastrami on it. Right? So the question, was there heat? So was there heat?
No.
The truth is not. So here's the thing. So here's a very important tip. Here's a very important tip. Discuss the pastoral element, we'll save for later. Right, the family dynamics we'll handle later, offline. Sometimes it often pays to freeze. But what I don't mean freeze in the freezer. What I mean is, sometimes you see a situation looks problematic, so the first thing is Hippocrates, or however you pronounce his name, taught us, the first thing to do is to do no harm. So for instance, that situation, it comes up all the time. When you have cold things get mixed together in the kitchen, and it's not good, you may not want to eat the food, but the first thing you want to do is make sure nothing gets worse. So here's an example of how things could get worse. So let's say you have I'll give you this chatayin mazkar yom, was once in someone's house, different state, and I thought I knew which were the milchik and fleishik bowls. I was wrong. I found out I was wrong because I was eating breakfast, I helped myself to cereal milk in a Karel bowl, And the fellow walks in and said, oh, the shach. So I knew what he meant, because the shach talks about that situation, about the cold milk and the cold fleshig bowl. Now, and the shach points out that that in and of itself does not create any problems. Because again, the milk wasn't sitting there for 24 hours, no, sitting there for a couple of minutes. Nothing's just not salty or vinegary, right? And obviously the spongy is an issue and sharp foods aren't an issue. And everything's cold. So right now, what I could do is eat my cereal milk in peace. And then the question is what happens afterwards. Because so far, there's no method of time transfer. So nothing happened. The milk stays milk. The fleishig bowl stays fleishig, but they're not. There's no way for them to share their flavors, so everything is fine. You wouldn't do that on a regular basis, because soon later you're going to make the following mistake, which is you turn up the heat. How do you turn up the heat? Exactly. So the most important thing to do is that sometimes things may have been kosher. Sometimes things became treif in use, but sometimes things stay or kosher in use, but they can become treif when you wash them. So let's say in that situation of my unfortunate mistake, very embarrassing, especially that was a scholar residence in the community. It was like that was like the first impression was like possible hovering out the window, but it really didn't. It was really okay. But what you have to do in that situation, the first thing you want to make sure is that you wash everything in cold water. You want to get it clean. You don't want to leave any milky residue on your fleishig bowl, because you don't know what's going to happen next time. Someone pours chicken soup in, still a little bit of milk. Then you got a problem, because now you have heat. So you want to make sure it's clean, but you don't want to use heat, because the heat is going to drive the milk into the bowl. Ah, excellent point. Excellent point. So that takes very important. That takes us back. So you're asking again about how hot is hot. That takes us back to the question of the two ways of defining Yatzlatos bowl. Right. So if you go for the higher end, if you're talking 160, 170, that I couldn't even maintain it, even if I knew it was hot. Right. So then washing dishes is not going to be a problem. But we are machmir for the lower end. Right. So if it's great. So if all that happened was that you washed it in cold water. Right. So okay. So great point. So let's say you talk about a sponge. You always have to remember two things. We're talking about absorbed. Up until now, we've been sort of focused on absorbed flavor. Right. This idea of this fancy halacha concept of tam keker. You also have to sometimes worry about actual residue. Right. So when you use a sponge, you may end up, again, depending on what the situation is, you have something where, well, I used a fleishig sponge on the milchik food, I may end up with fleishig milchik pieces. Right? But in terms of flavor transfer, so what you want in that situation is ideally take it to the bathroom sink so you don't end up with, you know, grease in the sink. Take it to the bathroom sink, wash it with cold water and soap, and it goes back in the cupboard and there's no need for anything. If it had been something hot, so then already we say, oh, something hot, there may have been an absorption of flavor into the bowl, and then we have to figure out, not throughout the bowl, but how are you going to extract that flavor out of the bowl using the kashering process that the Torah talks about. Yeah?
So if you want to wash it in hot because you want it to be very clean afterwards, so can you wash it in cold with soap so that the taste would be pleasant and it would be totally clean, but then you can wash it in hot water right away after?
Once it's clean. Once it's clean. It's clean. Yeah, did it ever end up in hot water?
No. We haven't used it since because I've been in hot water.
Right. No, it got washed out. I mean, I washed it with a fleishig sponge and they put it away, and it never gets used. It's a wooden salable, so it never gets used for anything.
Right. And if it was washed in cold water, then it is totally powerful. Absolutely. The lack of hot water kept you out of the hot water. Yeah. Meaning you had the... The normal reaction, or natural reaction to the discovering the fleishig bowl used for cereal milk would be, oh my, I can't believe that, and you quickly wash it. Is that what you're describing?
Sure, but right. You just had mentioned specifically like washing it like in a different...
Oh, I always recommend... I recommend doing the bathroom thing just so that you don't, because you're actually going to have... you're washing off your... You're washing the milk off the fleishig bowl. You don't want to have... Now, you don't want to leave milk sitting in your fleishig sink.
What if you like
that's fine too. Yeah, that's fine too.
Wash it in the dairy sink
too. You could wash it in the dairy sink also. It's the truth. People usually get a little ecklish about, I'm going to wash, you know, my fleishig bowl in the milchik sink. Right. And also, you don't want to use your sponge. You wouldn't want to use a milchik or fleishig sponge, because the sponges may actually have chunks of food. They may have detergent on them also. But it's usually simpler. That's why they say, usually it's a matter, as a rule of thumb, if you didn't, let's talk about what to do. But ideally, I would say in a case where there was no blia, there was no absorption of flavor, the simple thing to do is just take it to this bathroom sink, cold water and soap, and you're done. That's sort of the most streamlined, yeah.
Which sponge are you using? Fleishig sponge or milk sponge?
Just use your fingers, I don't know. Cold water and soap, rub it down, and you're done. And once it's clean, it's clean. Once it's clean, it's back to whatever it was. Milk and fleishig part. Yeah.
Salad was made
for more
than 18
minutes. Isn't that problematic? That's true. There was
vinegar in the dressing. Does that make it better? I'm sorry? We didn't cut the onions.
Did you cut the onions?
In the bowl.
The
onions were made...
But
it's
not
normally how you're going to make it a liquid that was covered.
Right. Yeah, but I...
Well, the bone has to be covered. Technically, it'd be cold.
Soaking,
is
it soaking the salad with
could
the
be
wet
soaking
salad?
Well, if you have a few pieces of the deli or the meat in the bottom of the bowl and the dressing kind of collects at the bottom of the bowl.
That's true.
But is it 24 hours?
If it's bland liquids, like milk or water, then 24 hours. If you're talking about vinegar... So if there was vinegar, if you ended up with vinegar on the bottom, like a pool of vinegar on the bottom of the bowl, that's a good point. If you end up with a pool of vinegar on the bowl and chunks of turkey floating in the vinegar, so then we may have to. You're still not in hot water. The bowl is in hot water. By which I mean,
how much vinegar would you need?
Now we move to then we're gonna have to think about koshering. We can kosher the bowl. Not a problem. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah,
but
how
even
much
with
vinegar,
vinegar
would
you
need in the dressing for it to be
consumed? Usually, balance out.
Good point. So on the other hand, great, fantastic. We're working that together. Well, the question is also, what was your dressing like? Now it's going to be hard to get a good handle.
It's oil vinegar, and sugar.
Balsamic vinegar.
And
I did it.
Whatever. It's oil vinegar and sugar.
Right. It's he'll bring a sample to next year.
In the bowl.
Ideally, on the table bowl.
Only the bowl's par.
Ah, well, by next week, the bowl will definitely be par.
Not my family.
Between now and next week, we can get the bowl to be par. So now let's talk about how we make the bowl par.
It's a wooden bowl?
Yes. So let's talk about how we can make... So if again... You had meats floating in the vinegar in the bowl for a couple of minutes. Or if you sort of just filled it with water without soap and let the meat sort of float there for 24 hours. Perhaps. That may or may not be a problem. Or if you rinsed it right away with hot water. So then it may or may not... need to be kosher. Again, so let's just want to review one key point. There are a couple of dimensions to time transfer. The first one is the method, different methods of transfer, right? The heat and the soaking and so on and so forth. If you don't have a method of transfer, so then for sure, nothing happened. If you did have a method of transfer, for instance, it was soaking in water for 24 hours or soaking in vinegar for 8 or 18 minutes, so then there's a possibility of a problem. There was a channel, there was an avenue through which flavor could travel. It may or may not have. But at least it's what, now we have what to discuss. So I'll give you an example of what I mean that may or may not have been a problem. Let's say you filled the bowl with cold water and you let it sit there for 24 hours. Right? And then the 36 hours later, you say, hey, 1 second, power of bowl, pieces of turkey floating in the water. Everything was cold, but there was kavush, right? There was a 24-hour soak. Okay, so then we say, okay, now there's at least a possibility. What to talk about? There's a possibility of a time of transfer. in that situation, there probably still is no, the bowl probably remains parv, because even though there was a method, but the second dimension to think about is quantity, or should I say dilution, right? If you have a lot of water, a salad bowl full of water with a couple of teeny tiny strips of turkey, so what flavor is entering? Yes, they're soaking. So there's flavor entering the bowl. Flavor of what? A flavor of everything that's in the bowl together. How much? That's predominantly water and vinegar and a little bit of turkey. So if in that mixture that's soaking in the bowl for 36 hours, you have not more than one part turkey to 60 parts of everything else. So it's the turkey is so diluted that it's not really going to make an impact on anything else. That's what we call bitul b'shishim. That whether it's a question, as a matter of fact, the water itself, right? As if I have tiny strips, tiny bits of turkey that were cooked in an enormous pot of soup or an enormous pot of vegetables, and I can figure out that the turkey was diluted by the 1-60 ratio, then the food itself might remain powerful. Because that's, but there's so little flavor, it's so diluted, that it's typically, unless you're dealing with a spice or a concentrate, you're talking about normal, typical, everyday foods, 1-60 is so diluted that even though there was heat, or there was soaking, or there was whatever it was, but it's so diluted that it's still not tasteable. So now we have a couple of tools. Number one, another dimension of Tom Kicker is quantity or dilution. And also to recognize that as I was saying before, if you have one of the methods of Tom transfer, that means there's what to talk about. It may or may not have transferred. May or may not. Right? So it was soaking, yes. But so diluted, that's not a problem. But let's talk about, but now let's assume there was a problem. Let's assume it was a hot salad. You had hot meat in the salad. Or you washed in hot water right away. So then already we have to say, or it was sitting in the vinegar soaking there. And there wasn't so much vinegar. It was, a pool of vinegar like this, and a significant amount of turkey. It wasn't, the turkey was more than as 1-60 with the vinegar. So, okay, we're going to have to kasha the bowl. So the most important thing to know is that this is usually a DIY project. Kashering is usually something you can do it yourself, you can do it at home. Sometimes there are the fact that many communities. I'll end with this. The fact that many communities traditionally have these like steaming cauldrons, communal cauldrons for kashering before Pesach, it does make it helpful. But it sometimes also creates a misimpression that kashering is a very complicated process you cannot do at home. So what we will start with next week is five easy steps to how to a kosher kli. The practicalities of how you go from treif to kosher, it's not so complicated. You have to know what to do and what order, based in part on the psukim in Parshas Matos. We'll talk about some other details of what kasher, you can kasher wood, you can kasher metal, some things you cannot kasher. We'll talk about that. Sometimes there are more complicated kashering processes. It's very important to have those practicalities down. And the next 30 seconds, we'll just review very briefly where we have been. The Torah talks in Parshas Matos about how to prepare the non-Jews' kelim for Jewish use. And the second thing you need to do is to tovel them. More to come. The first thing you need to do is to kasher them, which implies a concept of tam kicker that's not enough to just remove residue, but actually a flavor absorbed within the kli, and that can be removed. How the flavor get there through one of the various methods of tam transfer. Those methods of tam transfer either move flavor from food to food or from food to a kli. Torah's talking about even food to a kli. It tells us even you can have a two-step problem. The food from food to kli, then you can use it again. It's going to come out into your second food. The methods of tam, the first dimension of tam kicker, or the different methods of tam transfer, the heat as well as all the s's. The soaking, the salting, the spongy, or the sharp tool, the sharp food. And the second dimension of Tom Kicker was the question of quantity. Thank you so much, and I look forward to your questions over the course of the week. I look forward to continuing with Mirsam. Next time we will begin with Hagala Scale, with Kashrin Kale.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Who's this?